Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Wednesday, the 11th of May. A very good morning to you and welcome to Africa Link. I'm Eunice Onjiro in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, the Burundian Supreme Court sentences 21 coup plotters to life in prison. And in Tanzania's Nyarugusu refugee camp, life is tough for Burundian refugees.
There was a spot in a place called Kagunga, which is a small lake shore village. The estimate number there was around 60,000. There was nothing for them.
Amnesty International releases a report which states that 149 detainees have died as a result of horrendous conditions in Nigeria's Giwa barracks.
We've obtained photographs of some of those that died and had them subjected to analysis by a forensic anthropologist. Their analysis was that the images are consistent with a lack of access to food and water and death as a result of disease.
Stay tuned to these stories and more coming in the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
The Burundian Supreme Court has handed down life prison sentences to 21 army officers who were allegedly involved in last year's failed coup plot in May. The coup attempt followed rioting against President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term in office despite a constitutional two-term limit. Earlier on, I spoke to Yolanda Booker of International Security Studies, and I started by asking her what message the Supreme Court was passing across with this kind of verdict.
I think the Supreme Court and more generally the government is sending a clear message that it has no intentions on negotiating or discussing or having a dialogue with people the government perceives to be associated with the coup attempt of May of last year. This is a bit of a challenge considering the fact that the East African community has been trying to resume dialogue between the opposition and the ruling party. This particular ruling makes it clear that the government's refusal to discuss with people that they believe to be on the other side of the aisle is quite a firm position on the government side.
Can we expect that the verdict will trigger fresh violence in the country?
Well, it's difficult to tell because as we observed in the past year, violence is cyclical in Burundi. You have, you know, episodes of violence which are followed by a little bit of downturn and then a return to violence. The message that the Supreme Court, which is linked obviously to the regime, is sending is that those who are out fighting have very little chance to return to Burundi under peaceful circumstances. And that can lead to increased violence if people who are part of the armed rebellion believe that force is the only way to move forward, particularly if they're getting support from foreign governments or they're not being treated as the armed groups that they are. Unfortunately, the government is not leaving a lot of room for maneuver for the armed opposition with its refusal and continual refusal to engage in negotiation and discussion. It looks like the resolution of the conflict is further down the line and would possibly increase violence in the weeks and possibly the months to come.
Can we say that this was a fair trial?
You know, the first trial had 30 years sentencing for 9 of the accused, 5 years for 8 of the accused, and 7 people were acquitted. And they had legal representation in the first trial. This particular appeal, my understanding is that the accused had no legal representation, and not only the individuals who had been acquitted ended up having life in prison, but they're also now responsible to pay a significant amount of money as reparation to the government. And I think this was quite a political trial, and I don't think anyone could argue that this trial was fair.
And what role did the failed coup play in the Burundian crisis?
The failed coup was a turning point in the Burundian crisis last year. I think one of the most significant consequences of the coup attempt and the reprisal from the government was then the loss of independent media in Burundi and the inability for people throughout the country to get news that is not associated to or close to the government. So the lack of information, I think, instilled some panic in the population and contributed to some people leaving the country at a higher rate. You also have the fact that the government, in its retaliation, not only destroyed independent media, but also engaged in increasing repression of civil society organizations, civil society representatives, and that resulted in NGO leaders, political leaders in the opposition to leave the country.
What do we know about the people who are involved and their relations to the regime of Nkurunziza?
There's a wide array of people who were believed to have participated in the coup attempt. You have, of course, General Niyombare, who was an insider for some time to the ruling party, was chief of intelligence for a while and is not in custody at the moment and is in fact leading one faction of the armed rebellion. You also had people who were close to the former regime. You also had former fighters who rose in the ranks, and you had retired generals. So you had a wide array of people who were either at one point close to the former regime, close to the current regime. So when the government is trying to pin the coup attempt to a particular ethnic group, the reality, when we look at the people who stand accused of their participation in the coup, really shows the diversity of opposition to the current government.
Political analyst on Burundi, Yolande Buka. Burundi has been in crisis since April last year. Hundreds have been killed and 250,000 people have since fled the country. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, the number of those fleeing the country is expected to grow. Most of those displaced are living in fear of more violence at the Nyarugusu refugee camp on Burundi's border with Tanzania. But among all the other humanitarian crises in the world, their plight appears to have been forgotten. Nick Martin presents this report by Linda Stauder.
It was bad for us when we heard that civil war may return. The ruling party's speeches made us fear a new war and that I may lose my little children.
With memories of Burundi's 12-year civil war from the turn of the century still fresh in his mind, Michel didn't hesitate in fleeing with his family when violence broke out in his hometown last year.
I had enough. I grew up in a war. I lived in the bush for 4 years. I spent my childhood as a refugee in Tanzania. We are tired. It is hard to have no home. Sometimes people flee to the camps just to have a little rest from the war.
Michel, who's 32, along with tens of thousands of other people, fled Burundi after a failed coup attempt against President Pierre Nkurunziza. According to Amar Asiyama of the UNHCR, many of them lived in appalling conditions in a small Tanzanian town.
There was a spot in a place called Kagunga, which is a small lake shore village, 3 hours by ship from Kigoma. The estimate number there was around 60,000. There was nothing for them, but they were hosted, I have to say, by the local population who had nothing themselves. And until such a time that there was an outbreak of cholera.
So the UNHCR brought many patients, seriously ill with fever and diarrhea, to Nyarugusu on a German World War I warship, which had been serving as a tourist attraction on the lake. Over a 2-week period, dozens of trips were made, transporting around 300 people at a time.
Our objective of saving lives in all sense, like including the evacuation, emergency evacuation from the island, we call it island, all of it were achieved. But we still have great challenges in the camp.
Michelle, his wife, their 4 children and their grandfather live in a single tent. It has UNHCR emblazoned in blue across a once white background. But nearly a year of torrential rain and scorching sun has taken its toll on the family's spirit.
The tent has a hole over there where water can get in. We are next to the toilets, which many of us have to share. They aren't designed for so many people and are very dirty. They are not kept clean. There are 7 of us in a small room. It's not easy.
Nyarugusu is too small for the roughly 125,000 refugees from Burundi alone. A second camp is already full and others are planned. But wherever refugees are taken, there's a lack of basic necessities.
We don't know where to start, I have to say. It's like you have to do everything.
The UNHCR needs replacement tents, stoves, lamps and new water tanks. Makeshift schools are built with plastic sheeting, and there's a lack of medical facilities and medicine. The agency's funds just won't cover everything, despite budgeting 155 million euros for projects in Burundi this year.
I wouldn't say that the international community is not giving enough, but the truth is we know the situation of the humanitarian crisis in the world. And our emergency, unfortunately, has not captured the attention that other emergencies are having. And so it has been difficult. It has been very, very difficult.
And it's likely to get worse. Even in the crisis in Burundi is resolved quickly, many refugees have nowhere to return to.
That report was written by Linda Staude.
News, analysis and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
Rights group Amnesty International has released a report indicating that babies and young children have died in appalling conditions in military detention in the Giwa barracks in Maiduguri. They also found out that more than 7,000 people have died in military custody between 2011 to 2015. Many of the inmates are suspected Boko Haram members or sympathizers. My colleague Jane Ayeko-Kumet spoke to Daniel Eyre of Amnesty International. She started by asking him what kind of detainees were being kept in the Giwa barracks.
Giwa barracks is in Maiduguri, and that's really at the epicentre of the conflict. We estimate that at least 1,200 detainees are kept in the barracks. And these are people who are held on suspicion of being supporters or members of Boko Haram. But when we've spoken to people who were arrested or who witnessed these arrests, it becomes clear that many people have been arrested completely arbitrarily, often because they are young men that are in the wrong place at the wrong time.
In your report, you suggest that you've gathered evidence from former detainees and eyewitnesses. Apart from what they say, have there been any medical tests that confirm that the victims actually died of terrible conditions in the detention?
So one of the problems is that when people die in detention, no autopsy is conducted. They're simply taken away and buried. So there's no official account of what happened to them. We've obtained photographs of some of those that died and had them subjected to analysis by a forensic anthropologist. Their analysis was that the images are consistent with a lack of access to food and water and death as a result of disease. And that's exactly what people who were detained in the barracks are telling us, that they're not getting enough water, they're not getting enough food, people are losing weight as a result, and disease is rife inside the barracks. So those are the causes of death as far as we can establish.
Amnesty International also claims to have sounded alarm bells regarding the situation in the detention centre. What has been the government's response or reason for not acting?
The deaths in military detention are an issue that we've covered since 2013. Under previous administrations in Nigeria, we found that more than 7,000 people died in military custody between 2011 and 2015. That's a truly horrific number. Now, although steps have been taken in the last couple of years to try and improve conditions in military custody, we believe that recent mass arrests of suspects have erased those gains. We wrote several letters to both the military leadership and also to the government of Nigeria, asking them for more information and to comment on our findings. We're yet to receive a response.
Again, as Amnesty International, what steps have you taken to ensure that the relatives or the victims get justice or some kind of compensation?
Well, for a long time, we've been campaigning for investigations into war crimes and crimes against humanity that may have been committed by both sides of the conflict, both atrocities by Boko Haram and also the crimes by the military. And in fact, President Muhammadu Buhari last June promised that his government would investigate evidence of these crimes. We're yet to see serious action taken to start those investigations, and these latest deaths show why it's all the more urgent that those investigations begin and hold people to account for what's happened.
Amnesty International's Daniel Eyre speaking to my colleague Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
Behind the headlines.
Ever since Jacob Zuma was elected as South Africa's president in 2009, He has been caught up in one crisis after another. This includes the massacre of 34 miners in Marikana by the police, the continuing corruption scandal over the nearly 250 million rand of taxpayers' money spent on his Nkandla home state, and the public spat over claims that one of his benefactors, the Guptas, a wealthy Indian family, had tried to influence the selection of his ministers. As a result, Zuma's support is dwindling across the country. But who is President Zuma and what's his background? In Behind the Headlines this week, Subri Govender looks at Zuma's early life and the promises he made just before he was elected to office in 2009.
Firstly, I think it is important in my view that a head of state must know what are the people saying. And you cannot know that by just reading surveys. You can know it if you meet with people, they talk to you, you are able to appreciate their own positions and their situations. So I'll never change.
This is what Jacob Gedley Shlekiza Zuma told me in an interview just before he was controversially elected to succeed President Thabo Mbeki in May 2009. Unlike many other presidents, Zuma comes from a very humble background. A herd boy and living in poverty, he was forced to drop out of school at an early age after his father passed away and after his mother moved more than 250 kilometers away in search of work.
Firstly, my mother, my brother, was a domestic worker in Durban. And at times I would visit her where she would be working. In some places where she would be working, the visitors would not be allowed, including children. If I were to sleep, I would have to be smuggled in at night and smuggled out very early in the morning.
Infuriated at the injustices of the apartheid regime, he joined the ANC when he was 17 and later joined in the organization's armed wing. But within a year, he was arrested and charged with trying to overthrow the government. He was sentenced to 10 years on Robben Island. It's ironic that it was on Robben Island that he completed his matriculation with the help of other political prisoners. After his release, he continued with his underground work and in 1975 went into exile. When the apartheid regime finally crumbled, he returned in time to join the new government in 1994. But after he was elected deputy president to Thabo Mbeki in 1999, he became embroiled in fraud, racketeering and corruption charges. Although Zuma rejected all claims against him, Mbeki sacked him as his deputy in 2005. He became involved in a bitter struggle for power with Mbeki and succeeded in toppling Mbeki to be elected president in May 2009. Jacob Zuma came across as a leader who not only exuded values and principles, but also a leader who was committed and dedicated to free the majority of the people from the ravages of poverty, unemployment, and inequality.
If there are individuals that we would find that have joined the ANC because they want to abuse it for their own positions, we'll certainly deal with them. We'll not hesitate to deal with such people. But I'm telling you, there will be very, very few if they are found. The majority of the members of the ANC joined the ANC for one purpose only, to serve the people of this country.
But the question that is being posed now on a regular basis is this. Is Zuma living up to his pledges, or has he strayed from his commitment to serving the people? Matthew Sposa, a former Treasurer General of the ANC and a former Premier of the Mpumalanga province, is one of those ANC leaders who believes that Zuma has transgressed the moral and ethical values of the ANC.
I've said repeatedly, it would be very honorable for the President to step down. You don't need people to push you. You don't need a court to find you guilty. There are ethical issues here. The culture of immunity is sneaking into our politics, and we should fight it. You know, we don't have to hang you and say, now you're found guilty before you go. You should go on ethical and moral issues.
Zuma's reign as president is of concern to many South Africans. The only question is, when will it dawn on him that his credibility as a leader is now being questioned, and that the longer he stays, the more damage he is bound to do to the country and himself?
Subri Govender reporting. Germany is well known for raising donations for Africa, from people who are suffering from hunger to people who have lost their homes due to natural disasters. However, in Germany's small southwestern state of Saarland, tables have been turned. A small delegation from Goma in eastern DRC has come with a donation raised by members of a church. The money is meant to help women refugees who are still living in refugee camps here in Germany. This report by Bettina Rao is now presented by Wanjiku Mwaura.
Inside the envelope is $1,000, about 800 euros. The cash was raised by the church members of the Goma Baptist Church. A considerable amount, bearing in mind that the Democratic Republic of Congo is ranked as one of the poorest nations on earth. The Central African nation also has to cope with many refugees and internally displaced people due to ongoing conflicts. Kambala Kilumbiru Martin, the head of the church delegation from Goma, Eastern DRC, proudly hands over the donation to his host and colleague Christian Veya, which he says was given from the heart of the Congolese churchgoers.
C'est vrai que nous traversons des moments difficiles dans notre pays.
Though we are going through hard times in our country, we have still managed to stay in touch with our church partners here in Zara West. They help us every time when we are facing difficulties, so we thought we have to do something.
Nous ne pouvons pas nous taire.
It's been 30 years since the partnership between the Baptist community in Goma and the Protestant church Zara West was founded. To mark this anniversary, a delegation from Congo visited Germany to celebrate a session day in a joint church service. The Zaland community has also previously helped their fellow African faithfuls when they were going through hard times. In 2002, following the volcanic eruption in Goma, German churches and schools in Zaland helped rebuild the water supply system. The money from the African nation is seen as a sign of friendship. For Christian Veer, representative of the Zaa West Parish in Zaland, the monetary gift was a great gesture that they could not refuse.
We have always been there in times of need. In the DRC, there is still a great need of help, but I think it is a step of faith that our partners have seen our situation and said, yes, we are standing with you, and we will help even in material terms. I am overjoyed, but also humbled.
Erfreut, aber auch beschämt.
The $1,000 is meant to benefit the Nur Women's Project, an aid program in the Lebak refugee camp. There, refugee women, no matter where they come from, can receive counseling, for example, if they have been victims of violence. The affected women can also be accompanied to doctors or be guided to the authorities. The project also offers language courses. Abigail Kavugo, a member of the Congolese delegation, explains why the money was donated to a women's project.
When catastrophes happen, it's the women who suffer the most, women and young ladies. They are the ones who are the most vulnerable to violence, no matter what type of catastrophe.
Believers from the church near Lake Kivu are obviously delighted that they have managed to spring a surprise, money from Africa, which is donated in Germany. That's something that is very rare. For the guests from Goma, it was the perfect opportunity to give something back to their friends in Germany.
That report was compiled by Bettina Rao.
Opinion.
In Opinion this week, we would like to hear your thoughts on the verdict by the Burundian Supreme Court of life imprisonment that has been handed down to 21 army officers involved in an alleged coup plot of May last year. Do you think this sentencing will help resolve crisis in Burundi? We would also like to hear your opinion on our report about the Goma church members who donated money to help refugee women in the state of Saarland in Germany. What do you think about such a move? Send us your opinion on either one or both stories through text message to country code 491609575951 an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or a letter to Africa Link, DW53110, Bonn, Germany. And we will surely air some of your thoughts on Friday. And now a reminder of our main stories. Burundian Supreme Court sentences 21 coup plotters to life in prison. Amnesty International released a report which states that 149 detainees have died as a result of horrendous conditions in Nigeria's Giwa barracks. And we also heard how a church in Goma, Eastern DRC, has donated money to help women refugees in the German state of Saarland. Well, that's all we had for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again same time tomorrow. From me, Eunice Onjiro in Bonn. Have a pleasant day.